Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, and welcome to the American Patchwork and Quilting Podcast. I'm Lindsay Mayland, and I'm so excited to be here with you. When I say the word binding, what feelings come to mind? For me, binding is one of my favorite steps of the process. It means I'm almost finished with a quilt, and I get the chance to cozy up under it while watching a favorite movie and hand-stitching the binding in place, which I find very relaxing. But for some quilters, binding is a dreaded last step of the process and can cause some anxiety for finishing a quilt. No matter where on the spectrum you fall, I have some helpful tips to share today to make binding easier and quicker. Now, there's no way I can actually explain how to do binding through a podcast. So if you need details on how to bind, either by hand or machine, I'll link to some resources in the show notes to get you caught up. First, let's talk about preparing your binding strips. It's a helpful idea to prep your binding at the same time that you're piecing the quilt top. And this helps you avoid accidentally using the fabric you had planned for the binding on another project. And it also means that as soon as you're done quilting, you don't need to spend any extra time prepping the binding before you can finish. It's ready for you, ready to go. And I think it's a fun idea to store your binding around a paper towel or maybe a toilet paper roll. And that just helps keep it wrinkle-free. And I even think it's helpful to write the name of the project or the quilt right on that paper towel roll. In case you're working at multiple projects at once, or you have, you know, multiple bindings prepared, you know exactly what quilt it was meant for. If you're making a double fold binding, which is pretty popular, you'll have to fold and press that binding strip in half. And it can be a bit of a pain to press the strip in half, especially if you have a really long binding strip. And sometimes your fingers can get pretty close to that iron when you're kind of trying to maneuver the strip with one hand and hold the iron with the other. There are actually some tools out there, though, that can help. So our staff has a few recommendations. One is the Binding Ease by Quilting Hearts. Another is the June Taylor Quilt Binding Express. And the last one is the Third Hand Binding Folder from Purple Hobbies. And these tools both do the work of folding the binding as you kind of pull your strip through the tool, and it provides a place to press it with your iron. So each of these tools is slightly different. So we'll link to them in the show notes and you can check them out more. And maybe one of them fits your needs or exactly what you're looking for. But if you're finding that that ironing step is kind of tedious, these tools might just help with that. Now, if you have trouble deciding on which fabric will look best on binding, here's a trick to try. So to get an idea of how your binding fabric will look once it's cut and sewn to a quilt, you can cut a half an inch wide slit in like a square of cardstock or paper to make a viewing window. And that half inch wide is the width of the binding that you'll see on the front of your quilt. So you can then hold that little viewing window over different fabrics and look through it to see what the design will look like. So for binding like small print designs, solids, maybe like an all-over print, like a stripe, do work best, and a lot of people choose those type of things. Large scale or directional prints can sometimes look strange once they're sewn to a quilt or once they're cut skinnier, but sometimes, depending on the larger scale print or the colors of your quilt, using something like that can look really cool and give a really interesting effect. But this viewing window can kind of help you see that finished look so you can choose the best fabric option. And you can even skip the step of prepping your binding completely and just buy prepared binding. So we love getting ours from Kelly Marshall of Simply Macbeth. She's actually a frequent designer in our magazines, but she also sells these prepared binding in a variety of colors and prints. The binding is sized to fit a large throw, so it will work for most quilts, and you may have some left over to use for something else. And she sells kind of a mix of more classic designs like solids and stripes, but also some binding in more popular and current fabrics, like for instance, like a Bonnie and Camille design. So you may be able to find a new fabric binding to match your quilt for a more specific look. She does rotate out her fabric choices pretty often, so you'll want to be on the lookout for that. But we'll link to her store in the show notes in case this seems like a good solution for you. Now let's move on to the sewing step of binding. Once your binding is prepared, it's a good idea to lay your quilt out flat and then roughly lay your prepared binding strip around the quilt so you can make sure that your strip is long enough and also that the seams of the binding aren't hitting in the corners of the quilt. It's not the end of the world if the seam falls in a corner, but it does add a lot of extra bulk to those mitered corners when you're binding, and it can make them look less neat and less pointy than your other corners. So if you have the option to just adjust things slightly to avoid that, it's worth it. And depending on the method of binding you're doing, you may have a little extra bulk where you start and end your binding strip. So not all methods of binding have that bulk, but some of them do, where the beginning and ending of the strips slightly overlap, so you have a little more fabric where they come together. So if you do use one of these methods, you may want to consider starting to sew your binding on where the bulk will be less obvious. So for example, I always like to start my binding in a bottom corner of my quilt because that's not where your eye is usually drawn when you're looking at a quilt. So I think it's a little less obvious. You can also choose to start where the binding colors match with the quilt top to blend a little better. Not all quilts are designed that way, and you might not even be using a binding color that matches colors in the quilts, but sometimes starting that binding where the colors might meet up can help. One of my favorite tips I have ever heard for binding, and still have yet to try, came from teacher Susan Cleveland. And she told us in an interview we did with her on a previous podcast that she doesn't square up her quilt or trim her batting and backing even with the quilt top until after she's sewn the binding on, because it keeps the seams from popping, it keeps threads from unraveling, and it provides a little extra stability when sewing the binding on. Susan explains it in much more detail than I do. So if you want to hear her, listen in to episode 479 of this podcast. And she has a lot of other tips and tricks too. It's a great interview, but this one especially stood out to me, and it's one I want to try soon. And now a few more tips for finishing your binding. If you're binding the binding to the back of your quilt by hand, try using hand quilting thread, which is a coated thread. So because it has this coating on it, it doesn't tangle as easily. So you can usually cut a pretty long length of hand quilting thread, like maybe about 3 feet when binding. And this just means you're spending less time tying knots and burying threads, less time untangling threads. And I just find that the coating on the hand quilting thread glides through the fabric so easily to make binding easier, and it's also thicker than normal piecing thread. So you can tug on it, pull on it, and it does not break, it doesn't snap, and it holds up to washing really well. It's my favorite tip to share with quilters, and once I started using hand quilting thread to bind my quilts, I couldn't go back. I cannot imagine doing it any other way. In fact, I struggle when I try to use normal thread now. If you bind your quilts completely by machine, you might want to consider holding the binding in place, when you fold it over to stitch that second stitching line to hold it in place, either with Wonder Clips, or you can even use dots of a fabric glue or just a washable glue like Elmer's. And this just frees up your hands for sewing, so you can have all of your hands' attention on pushing the quilt through the machine. And it just makes sure your binding stays exactly where it needs to be to get that nice straight stitch, that nice finished look. And then the glue washes out in the wash. So it's a pretty clever trick. So there you have it. It's some of our best tips for making binding easier and quicker. Of course, we'd love to hear any genius tricks you have for binding. We think it would be fun to compile more of these and share it on the podcast at a later date. We know binding is something people struggle with, and we know there's a lot more great tips out there for making it easier. So you can email us any tips you have at apqpodcast@meredith.com. We'll list the email in our show notes. So if you have something to share, you can reach out to us there. We're going to take a quick ad break, but when we come back, we're chatting with designer Mary Blythe.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. I'm now handing the mic over to Elizabeth Stumbo, the art director of American Patchwork and Quilting, for her chat with Mary Blythe. So we just featured Mary in the October 2021 issue of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine. So if you have that issue or you're a subscriber, you've been lucky enough to see the photos of her beautiful space and projects. But for those who don't know Mary, she is a talented hand crafter, best known for her wool applique designs and rug hooking. She's the former owner of the Woolen Needle store in Williamsburg, Iowa. And she's also a teacher, author, and lover of antiques and history. She has so much to share for us today, so please enjoy the chat.
Hi, Mary. Welcome to the podcast. I am just so thankful that you are joining us today to talk about all things quilting and wool.
Yes, thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation. So we had the pleasure of featuring you and your designs in our current October 2021 issue of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine. And I am just so thrilled to introduce you now to our podcast listeners.
Thank you. Thank you. I was honored to be asked by Jody a year ago to have a pattern featured in last year's magazine, and then did the Instagram takeover. And from there, it led to the feature that is in this current issue.
Yeah, it's on newsstands right now, so people can pick it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a beautiful feature. I had so much fun designing that, and the photos were just beautiful of your space. So we were so honored to be able to feature you too, and have you be a longtime contributor to our magazines. That's been really great too. So
thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I would say that you are best known for your beautiful wool patterns, but really you embrace a variety of what you describe as heirloom crafts. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about that term heirloom crafts and a little bit about yourself and how that passion for those crafts and textiles and quilting really began?
To me, heirloom crafts are crafts that our mothers, grandmothers, and great-grandmothers did to pass the time and also to make products for their home. I love rug hooking. Have always loved the look of it. Stumbled upon a class in the early 90s in Kansas City and learned a lot about wool there from Emily Leas and just fell in love with wool in general. From there, I just continued to rug hook. I was a stay-at-home mom, so that was my hobby. And my hobby soon turned into a desire to open a shop. I knew in Williamsburg that a wool shop was probably not going to stand on its own. So I brought along a couple friends and it was a wool and quilt shop called the Wool and Needle. And there I dyed the wool for the shop and out of necessity just started designing wool applique at that point and really had not done a lot of wool applique, but soon fell in love with it and again designed our own and started incorporating the wool in not only into wool applique or rug hooking, but also started using it on quilts instead of doing needle turn cotton applique because I was not a quilter and still am not, but do appreciate quilts and especially the reproduction quilts that you see. So that's, I guess, my definition of heirloom crafts, mm-hmm. Those that have been passed down as well.
Yeah, just making beautiful things for your home, almost out of yes. necessity, but now it's just become such a beautiful passion and crafts in their own right.
Yes.
So just beautiful. Well, being a fellow Iowan, I have had the pleasure of visiting the Wool and Needle numerous times over the years. And I just have to tell you that you created such a beautiful shop. Just that what you started there and the patterns you continue to design are just beautiful.
Thank you. Selling it in 2011 was difficult, but I felt I was leaving it in good hands with the friends that I had in there. And I was starting to miss things at home. And so sold it in 2011 and just started actually designing at home then after that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still dye your own wools for yourself for your own use? Or do you have a large enough stash now that you're kind of set for a while?
Well, as you can see the pictures there, I do have a very good stash, but the problem with rug hooking, with wool applique, and if you're working on a new design, you have colors and textures in your mind when you go about designing a piece. And amazingly enough, you can have all the wool in the world and that piece that you need just isn't there. So I have started dyeing again here in my home. I'm lucky enough to have an area away from my kitchen with a cooktop and able to do it here at home because not only do I need certain colors that I may not already have in my stash, but I have also begun teaching again and needed to do a bit of kitting for that and didn't quite have enough. So I really do enjoy the dye process and I'm glad to be back at it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting process to learn. Were you self-taught or did you take some classes or apprentice with other people? Or is it just kind of experimentation over the years to know what works?
I actually just kind of was self-taught, talked to a few teachers, kind of saw their setup at a few retreats that I had been at. And my first dye formula book was Emily Leas's and Barbara Carroll's. They're very well known. Emily sadly has passed, but Barbara, they together came up with a wonderful dye book of primitive colors. And I worked off of that for quite a while. And then kind of changed my dye company that I was getting my dyes from, and then in turn came up with my own formulas from there. But I was basically just self-taught, because back when I started, there wasn't a lot of teaching going on as far as how to dye.
Yeah. Do you still find yourself surprised by certain things you dye, or do you kind of have it all down as a formula? Okay.
Oh, yes. And what's really sad is I did save my formulas from when I was at the shop. And then, of course, over the last 10, 12 years, the names of the dyes have changed and they've discontinued certain things. So I am having fun playing around with it. I do have a lot of different reds because I wasn't quite finding the right red. So I think I have every shade of red that I will need for quite a while.
Red is a tricky color to get right. And I think a lot of people call like that true red or cardinal red. Like that can mean different things to different people. So I totally understand that.
Yeah.
Well, that's fun that after all of these years, you still have surprises and are continuing to learn and as you go. So that's always exciting.
And on the dye side, actually, don't be afraid of ever picking up an ugly piece of wool. That is, wool is great because you can change whatever color. I mean, if you like the plaid that's going on in it or the check or the texture or anything of that sort, don't be afraid of picking up that ugly piece of wool. You can always change the color of it.
Yeah, that's nice. It's a lot of freedom there.
Yes.
I'm curious, where do you find those raw pieces of wool? I know, you know, if someone's doing it on a smaller scale, they might go to like a secondhand shop or something and pick up an old piece of clothing or whatever. But I'm wondering where you find those raw materials.
I used to do it that way. But, you know, because of the quantity that we use, I have several suppliers or three suppliers that I basically use that come out quarterly with swatches, and they just end up, you know, coming up with these beautiful wools. The sad thing is that there's not many wool mills out there anymore. So the selection can be limited, but you know, they do a beautiful job of doing that. But sadly enough, COVID has affected their operation too as well. And so, you know, they're backed up as far as what they're able to get as well. So I do buy from the Wool Studio out in Pennsylvania, Heavens to Betsy, and the Door Mill Company. They're all great, long-standing companies, and they do a very good job of coming up seasonally with new pieces.
Yeah, I just find the whole process fascinating that you can take someone else's like beginning raw product and then just completely make it your own and reinvent it in a way. So I love talking about hand dyeing things. That's great.
Yes.
Yeah. So your style, when you're designing patterns and coming up with new designs, do you find yourself kind of drawn to the same familiar color palettes or techniques and motifs? How would you describe your style? Is it kind of folk art style for those that might not be familiar with your patterns?
Right. I would say my style is a refined primitive. I love primitive antiques, early American antiques, and I wouldn't say my pieces are primitive. To me, that is a little rougher than what I do. I love the primitive color palette, the darker muted colors, and my elements are detailed, but yet they're not finely detailed. I tend to, if I have to have a detailed aspect of my design, I generally use it or have that come across in stitches rather than in the wool, just because teeny tiny little pieces are really hard sometimes to fuse and tuck under other pieces to make that concept work or to have your element look like what you want it to look like. So I tend to not make my designs too complicated. And I also, because Well, applique started with the penny rug and people used coins, you know, to make their circles. Most of my designs have some sort of circle penny in them. Very few do not. I don't know. I've just always been drawn to that look. But thank God for AccuCut and pre-cut circles, because as you know, no one can draw, or they can draw maybe a perfect circle with a stencil, but you cannot cut a perfect circle. And there are times when I don't use my pre-cut circles, but a lot of times I do just to save time and frustration. But yeah, I would call my style more of a refined primitive. Definitely not. I don't design on the bright end of things. If I do a spring design at all, the colors would be more on the muted, softer tone than anything bright.
Yeah. That's so great. So I was also just curious, what first drew you to wool? You said you started with rug hooking, but then you started to discover that you could also kind of, you know, do applique with it. For any of our listeners that might not have dabbled in wool before, what are some of those things that you love about working with wool?
I love the portability of it. We travel a lot, and just being able to put your pieces together, because I do use the heat and bond method of fusing my wool to my finished foundation. And also I take circle pennies on the go with me everywhere. So the portability is huge. And just the fact that you don't need a lot of supplies to work with it. You basically a scissors, needles, thread, and you know, your wool and whatever design you choose to use. I love rug hooking because of the look of it, and just the designs are amazing, and you can just do so many fun things with it. But it's really one of those crafts that, you know, you need a frame, you need a hook, you need your foundation piece and all that. And it can be a little clunky to travel with. And with wool, I mean, I throw it in a bag, throw it in my purse, and, you know, you can do it in the car, at ball games, for those people that are sitting at ball games and athletic events. And
yeah, those can be long hours sitting on bleachers.
Yes, yes, yes. And you can get a lot done in that amount of time. So
I bet.
So basically the portability of it, and I just love the look of it, and most people, and if you rug hooking, to me takes more time. And if you're wanting to do a gift for somebody, wool applique is a lot simpler. It fits into most homes and it's a lot less expensive than, you know, doing an entire rug for somebody as a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have dabbled a little bit with wool applique, and I love, like you said, like the portability of it, and that it's just like a simpler introduction to applique than, you know, traditional applique, needle turn and everything. But I also love, especially what I get when I look at your patterns, are this beautiful dimensions and all of the textures you get with wool too. I just think that you can't achieve that with other things a lot of the time. So
right. And I in my rug cooking class, my initial one I took from Emma Lou, she did not use a flat piece of wool in any of her rugs. She used what I call as is pieces, pieces that actually hadn't even been dyed yet, plaids, tonal textures, you know, tone on tone pieces, tweeds, herringbones, houndstooth, and it just adds a different dimension to your pieces. And so then I carry that on in a wool applique, and it just, a lot of times the plaids and stripes or whatever you have going on can do a lot of the explaining of what you want your element to be without having to do a lot of extra stitching. And plus it just adds interest. You do have to be careful. I'm currently color planning some Christmas stockings, and as much as I love texture, you still have to have those somewhat quiet pieces too within your design, so you don't have too much going on you know, within your project. But yeah, they do add a fun, and they're, it's, plaids are an awesome way to help bring your project together, because it can bring in all the, you know, several of your colors that you have in your piece and just kind of, you know, put the finishing touch on it.
Hey, it's Lindsay. Sorry to interrupt, but we have to take a quick ad break. We'll be back soon with more from Mary.
So, well, in the magazine feature, we have featured some beautiful photos of your home sewing space, and it just looks like an incredible space to just pursue all of your hobbies in.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I love it. I love it.
Do you just spend a lot of hours down there?
Yes, I do. I do.
Yeah, it looks like an incredible space. For our listeners, could you describe your space a little bit for them?
Well, I would say it is just warm and cozy and old. I just have always loved history. I love reading historical fiction and just kind of, you know, trying to experience what it must have been like back in the day. And so I love filling my spaces with antiques and actually pieces from the past. I've been fortunate enough to have a couple quilts from my great grandmother's, a sampler and some other pieces. So I love incorporating those pieces into my decor, and just, I love using them to store things. I have in the magazine, there's pictures of my spool cabinets. I was able to have my hardware store just make me some simple little grid pieces. And so I use that for all my pennies, because in the beginning, it wasn't a problem. But as I continued to design and cut and all that, they were getting out of control, and trying to find what I needed was impossible. So that has really helped keep myself on track. And then I also use it for my Valdani that I use, so I'm not struggling in bags and trying to dig around and find what I need. But and having the wool on display on the shelves, it's inspirational to me. I just love the look of it, for one, and just it gets me excited to see, oh, okay, what can I plan with this, or where can I use this piece in a next project that I'm doing. But just having it available and just being able to see it all the time just kind of inspires you to do something new.
Yeah, I love that you have used some of those antique pieces in a new way that works for you. So they're not just for display, they're also functional. Right. And I find that's really fascinating. So
yes, yeah. I do that a lot. And I love using old enamel pans and trays for just keeping things separate projects and, you know, pattern pieces and things like that I may be working on, and then I get sidetracked a little bit and say, oh, well, this would look good in this project. So then I'm able to throw those pieces on a different tray and just kind of try to keep things straight. My studio right now, I wouldn't want you to see it, because like I said, I'm in the middle of color planning 6 different Christmas stockings, and it's a disaster.
I mean, I'm sure it's the most beautiful disaster, though, with all of those colors.
Gotta love creative spaces. I try.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you surround yourself with some beautiful heirloom pieces while you are creating heirloom pieces that you're going to hand down and inspire other people's with. So it's really a beautiful space.
I sure hope people feel that way about my pieces and try real hard to think of how they may be used with the next generation using them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And things that you can just bring out all the time, because so many of your pieces too are seasonal inspiration too. Mm-hmm. So it's fun to pull those out and bring them out every year and remember making them or having been gifted them from someone else. Yes. So yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, we're kind of wrapping up our time here, but I always like to end with a few what we call our rapid fire questions here at the end of the interview. So I have 5 questions for you. So you can just say whatever first comes to mind.
Okay.
Okay. First question is, what is your favorite season to design for?
Fall.
Fall.
Love the colors, love the season, love all the textures, and yeah, just love it.
Yeah. Love it's it. Such a great season, especially for wool. It's just like, you just want to be warm and cozy.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Great. What is a technique you want to learn or maybe pick back up again?
I really want to spend more time rug hooking. I do miss it. I just want to dedicate more time to that. And I have so many projects that are partially done. And as you know, many of us have those, but I would really like to get back to doing a little bit more of that.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of touched on this a little bit already, but what is the current project you are working on right now?
Well, bless her heart, one of my daughter-in-laws, she asked if I would do some stockings for her children. So then it blossomed into asking my other four sons and their families, which include right now 9 grandchildren. So I have designed 6 stockings. And again, I'm just down to color planning and putting together the last of the 6 designs. And then I will start manufacturing in bulk all of the stockings and then get them out hopefully early to mid next year.
Okay, great. Yeah. Countdown to Christmas is on. Mm-hmm. Gotta get those stockings ready.
Yes.
And I love that you're making it fair and making them for all the grandkids. You gotta be equal.
Yes, yes, yes. No.
Go ahead.
There's been a disclaimer put out that they may not all get done by this Christmas. So
yeah, that's totally understandable.
Yes.
I feel like you need that disclaimer on any handmade gift, right?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe you can just end up showing a picture of what it will look like.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Someday.
Someday they'll have it.
Yeah.
Okay. My next question is, what do you love about quilting and wool community?
I guess, and I experienced this a couple weeks ago, I was able to teach out at the Wild and Woolly Escape in Shipshawana, Indiana, and it was the first time I had taught in a long time. And I guess it's just the willingness of everybody to help each other out, to encourage each other. It was just a really nice group of ladies. There was beginners to more advanced, even quilt shop owners that took some of my classes. And I didn't feel that anybody was made to feel bad for what they didn't know. Students were, you know, just interacting very nicely, you know, just sharing their knowledge, in between the time that I was, you know, sharing with them. And that, I really love that. It's not all about the teacher. It's about, you know, just people helping each other out to further their hobby and the craft and to keep the interest alive.
Yeah. Love that. All right. So we've talked a lot about heirloom things today. I'm curious if you have someone in your life that you are currently passing on your love for wool to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I talked in the feature too. My granddaughter Larson has been stitching with me since she was about 3.5, 4 years old, and she will turn 7 next week. So she has really taken, you know, wool and done her own thing with it. She has been able to, you know, graduate from a tapestry needle now to a needlepoint needle. She's designed some of her own pieces, and I hope her little sister, and she's got 2 little girl cousins right now that, you know, will hopefully be just as interested. And the boys are as well, more so with the tools and wielding them as weapons. But I just want them to enjoy being creative, and wool lends itself to that. And she gets pretty excited, and so I get excited as well.
Yeah, that's great. I love that you're passing that on. Mm-hmm. It'll be fun to see what she comes up with over the years.
Yes. So. Yes.
Great. Well, Mary, thank you so much for being on our podcast today. I've loved our conversation together, and I can't wait to just pull out my next wool project and get started. It's the perfect time of year.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and good luck with whatever you decide to pull out. I'm sure it'll be amazing.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Lindsay. Thanks to Mary and Elizabeth for that wonderful chat. I just love hearing how Mary translates her love of antiques and her just creative spirit into such beautiful designs. She really breathes life into her creations through texture, color, and stitching, and it's so inspiring. We'll link to Mary's website and social media sites in our show notes so that you can connect with her more. And if you've been wanting to try working with wool, Mary's book, her patterns, and even some kits for her projects are available at quite a few stores, which you can find at her website. Before we leave today, I wanted to share a review of the podcast. So this review comes from Quirk Quilter, and they say, "I found this podcast in March of 2020. Ever since, I look forward to new episodes on Mondays. I also go back to the plenty of older episodes and keep getting great tips each time I listen. Hearing the hosts' friendly voices has been great for my stress and encourages me to keep up with my quilt projects. I'm so thrilled that Quirk Quilter found us. I think the start of the pandemic brought a lot more quilters into the world of podcasts to just stay connected, and we're so glad to have you as one of our listeners." So thanks so much for this kind review. If this review is yours, please email us at apqpodcast@meredith.com. The email is listed in our show notes. We'd love to send you a little gift to say thank you. And as always, we'd love for our listeners to rate and or review the show. It truly helps other quilters find us, and it means the world to our staff to know other quilters are enjoying the show. Everyone, have a great week.